found out that isn't quite the thing to do. So listen, pal, to me, and surely you'll agree.
The sun shines much brighter than he's ever shone before.
Okay, it's Radio Misterioso here on August 8th, 2004, and as promised, Bill Moore is here, and a surprise guest, Walter Bosley. Again, let me turn on your microphones here. Turn that down. See if I can hear you. Are you there, Bill, Walter?
Hello, I'm here.
I am here.
Bills is not coming through.
Bill is not here.
Try again.
Am I here now?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Okay.
I wonder what happened to me.
I wonder too, but it was probably a function of the...
Into a different dimension briefly and back again.
Function of the ancient board. Maybe you two should switch microphones because you tend to be further away from the microphone than Walter does. This one seems to pick up things a little bit better. Just remember to sit right on top of that.
What we could do is, if you prefer to stand, we can just switch the mics.
Yeah, that would have been a better idea. So,
just to confuse you.
Well, while they're switching microphones, I'll remind you this is Radio Misterioso, and God, how can I introduce Bill Moore? Most recently, author of The Spalding Enigma, who wrote the Book of Mormon,
yes,
which is coming out this fall. Do you know exactly what month this fall?
I do not know, but I expect it's going to be late fall.
All right. In time for the Christmas rush.
Hopefully.
So all the Mormons can
everyone
give each
will
other
be,
that.
Everyone will be rushing, yes.
And, of course, infamous for his involvement with Paul Benowitz and that affair, which we've talked about quite a few times on this show, and as the quote-unquote discoverer of the MJ-12 documents, which we probably won't mention too much, but I do have one thing we can go into for a little while. And what else are you doing at the moment, Bill, besides sitting there and wearing that great alien abductee shirt?
Yes, well, it explains why I wasn't here briefly, you see. I was abducted.
I see.
Must be.
Oh, and Walter Bosley, who's here every so often as a co-host, former FBI, now I always get it wrong, agent.
FBI. I was a specialist with the FBI.
Specialist.
So you can say employee, FBI yes. employee.
And a special agent with the Air Force.
Air Force OSI. The
yes.
Evil Air Force.
So, because everybody's drooling about that, well, I suppose we'll talk a little bit about that, too. I typed up a bunch of subjects we can get into here. I don't know. Do you want to get the UFO stuff out of the way? I did see on the updates list somebody had a Mothman photo recently, but it was taken in Ohio or something. It was a picture of something jumping off a bridge, kind of standing at the top. I can bring the picture up. Standing at the top of a bridge and then kind of taking off away from it. In the second picture, it's about, you know, 20 or 30 feet away from the bridge and still at almost the same level as the... I don't know what that is. And
what city?
I can look it up. I should have put it on here. The only thing I put on here is links were the weird things in the Mars photos that came out in the news about a week ago. Not rock shaped like English letters and things like that that Hoagland said he was seeing, but actually something that appeared to be.
Was that in conjunction with the thing where my Yahoo headline said NASA says life on Mars likely?
You know, I don't know if it would have to be a pretty big leap from likely life on Mars to something floating in the field of view of the camera, which one of the pictures is. But it's, of course, it's so far away you can't tell what the hell it is because it might as well be a speck. Mm-hmm. But it does appear to be as far away as the furthest thing in the picture.
Well, so did you see that headline?
No.
Yeah, I remember it on Yahoo this week a few days ago. It said NASA : life on Mars likely.
Hmm.
Likely what?
They used to say possible. What's that mean? If the rovers go long enough or they get enough money, they can find it?
They're just getting closer to telling the truth. That's all. Right, Bill?
Well, it seems as if, at least in the case of the, which one it is, the Spirit Rover, I guess it is.
Yeah, that's the one that had the pictures.
Pretty clearly there was a lot of water on Mars at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the rock structures that I've seen pictures of on the website are quite unusual, but I haven't seen any indication yet that they might actually be fossils or something alive. But, you know, conditions may have been a lot different at one time than they are now.
There we go.
At least on the surface.
Well, I would expect if there's any kind of primitive life on Mars, it's going to have to be underground right now, because the surface seems pretty inhospitable. Yet, you know, the rovers have found such a variety of things. I don't think anyone expected that they were going to find all of these different types of clearly sedimentary rocks and almost calcite-like structures inside some of them.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And, you know, that's the sort of thing that calcite, especially on Earth, is connected or associated quite frequently with the shells of primitive animal life.
Yeah. Limestone.
So I would guess, without having seen your headline, that may have been the basis for it. Identifying calcite might have prompted that.
Yeah, well, maybe there's large limestone caves on Mars that we haven't seen yet, kind of like here.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah. But they didn't want to land in any mountainous regions because the rovers would not deploy properly, I think.
Well, the Spirit Rover, I think, is now almost at the top of the Columbia Hills, the last time I checked on it.
Didn't it look down over the other side, and there's these sand dunes there? I saw those there.
That's
too.
The other one in the crater.
Oh, okay.
It's going down into the Opportunity Crater.
Uh-huh.
And there's these weird-shaped sand dunes down in the crater. It's headed for them, yeah.
And there was another picture of dust devils taken from the orbiter. These
cool.
huge, you know,
yeah.
probably couple-mile-long sandstorms that looked like that you could see from the top they were swirling.
Hmm. It seems as if, you know, Mars is similar in composition to the Earth, but smaller, and therefore, and farther from the sun, it most likely cooled faster and earlier. And I think that might also account for the apparent large amount of iron hematite on the surface in the form of these so-called blueberries, which are really unusual things.
Uh-huh.
You know, finding so many of them, they seem like they're everywhere on that one site. And it seems pretty clear that they were formed by water.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, you know, I was off in, I don't exactly remember where it was, but it seems to me it was Utah someplace.
I was just about to say, I was hiking in Utah and I saw the same thing.
And I picked up a rock and it had some of those in it. I still have one of them. And, you know, it's an unusual looking thing when you look at it, but it seems to be the same as what they're seeing on Mars, only the one I have is a little bit bigger.
Yeah. When I was hiking, I was coming down this large sandstone, what's called slick rock, and I thought they were old posts from fence posts or something, because there were these things that were round and they were kind of corroded and were sticking halfway out of the rock. And they all actually had rust marks on the rock from the iron corroding, oxidizing, and I looked closer, there was no pattern to them. They were all over the place. These iron spheres that were embedded in the sandstone.
Hmm.
So that's quite, and obviously that sand, well, a lot of the sandstone out there was just sand, and it just got compacted, and not all of it was seafloor. In fact, if it was seafloor, there's probably limestone and other things pressed in between it because of all the sea life that was mostly shelled sea life at that time. Oh, you know what? I have to tell Walter about this because I told you when I went out to Death Valley. I went out to Death Valley last week, Walter.
Without me, you bastard.
Yeah.
Even after we planned to go together.
Yeah, but we're going tomorrow.
No, I've got a photo shoot tomorrow. However, mean, come on, man, priorities.
I got out there at 3:30 in the morning. Around 3 o'clock, we were coming up from Baker.
Yeah.
And there's a turn there at, I think it's, I'm not sure if it's Shoshone. I think Shoshone's a little bit further. But I looked up to the right, and there was this very bright white light hanging over one of the mountains. And my girlfriend said, oh, that's just a plane or something. I said, well, it's not moving. It's just sitting
Which
there.
Mountain?
There's no real mountains on the right side, are there? On the east side of the valley. East side, towards Nevada.
There,
I mean, when you get in there, there are mountains because you're in a valley. But when you're on the surface there, there are some hills, but they're not very high. And this is above where the hills were.
Okay.
And the road kind of makes a very sharp left turn, sharp west
turn. So you're still west of the Funeral Mountains that look into Nevada?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know how far away it was because it was at night. Like I said, it was about 3:30 in the morning. There's this bright white light. It's kind of sparkling, and I thought, well, it couldn't be a star because it wasn't there 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I would have seen it. It's right in front of us. As we made the turn, I suddenly noticed there was this light. And we kept driving, and the whole time we were driving, the light, I don't know if it was the road moving, but the light seemed to change position, but I didn't see it because I had to drive.
Yeah.
And I couldn't look and see what it was. And, you know, we saw four other cars, you know, the whole time going from, for, you know, 100 miles going from Baker down to Furnace Creek. And so finally, when we got to Furnace Creek, I stopped the car, checked in the hotel. This is 3:30 by now, and the light was still up there. But
now,
the thing
this
was,
is
we were
above the peak of the mountain,
yeah,
or okay?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, it was against
it
the sky.
Moving,
it wasn't
I
against
think.
The mountain.
It appeared to move because we were, you know, driving, but and changed position. But the road, you know, turns and things. So obviously, in the back mirror, if you're looking in the back window, if you're looking, it looks like it's going different. But the road is doing this. So when we got to the hotel, I took out my binoculars to look at it.
Yeah,
I had some, I guess, 50-power binoculars, and the light, it was white, and it looked like kind of a, not quite round, but flattened round, like maybe a flying saucer, but not quite flat. It was just kind of oblong, and it was kind of changing shape. It kind of went like this, and then it would get round, and then it would go this way, and then it would get round again.
You're kidding. Really? Seriously?
Yeah. Through the binoculars. Without the binoculars, it just looked like a bright, very bright white light hanging over, and it didn't move. And I went to sleep because I just got tired of looking at it, and I was tired.
So then, did you go? What'd you do? I mean, did you go look in the area the next day or anything? Or
no, I looked up there, and there was no mountain at the height that light was. Because my girlfriend kept saying, "No, it's a light at the sitting on top of a mountain." I said, "Lights on top of mountains are blinking red lights. It's to keep
airplanes
from hitting it."
This was white.
I asked Bill about this, and he said, "Well, was it over the west?" I mean, the west side of the valley, and you said it would be China Lake?
Might be something out of China Lake on that side, but on the side you saw it, that seems to rule that out.
So the closest thing on that side is the Nevada test site, test area.
Yeah.
I don't know how far up north that goes. I guess it goes from the Air Force base, well, it's Air Force or government property from a little bit north of Vegas, and then it just widens out and gets bigger as you go towards.
What's the name?
You would have been roughly on the same level with the Jackass Flats and the Rocket Range and so on over there, but that would be, what, 50 miles anyway, further to the east.
I couldn't tell how far away it was. I don't know if it was a legitimate UFO to me because I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
It was floating, though. It wasn't flying. It just sat there.
That's interesting.
Swamp gas.
Yeah, must have been.
All the swamp area out there. That's interesting considering we were going out there that day to take a look at something on another subject.
Bright white light, just changing shape.
A good thing I didn't go and you went with the girlfriend, because if you and I had gone, we might not be here right now. You know what I mean?
You didn't have any missing time, did you?
No, I checked the clock when I got there.
Didn't roll into the hotel 4 days later?
I don't wish I had. I don't know if I want to wish that on anybody. But the thing... Oh, there was another thing on the UFO updates list, which I just joined and I kind of looked. There was somebody was wondering if people that got abducted had more of a creative or artistic temperament than others, because the abductees seem to make really good drawings for the most part.
Sounds like wishful thinking.
Very, very, you know, not to say that they're fantasy prone or anything like that, but there's something in somebody's mind that's a more creative bent that would allow them to see that, or if you're a skeptic, make up those stories or hallucinate them.
That's an interesting question, but I don't know of anybody that's done any meaningful work around anything like that. Do you?
No, people were asking about it.
Maybe it's just the creative ones that talk about being abducted and having those experiences.
Or that draw something.
I mean,
if you can't draw, you're not likely to try.
Well, I've seen some really bad drawings, too. So, you know, who knows? Yeah, for some, that reminded me of something else that I had thought about with the abduction thing. Oh, well, never mind.
Did you have any encounters with interesting or strange people while you were out there?
No. I mean, we went to sleep after everybody got there, and then we got up after everybody had left.
In this,
only a busload of Germans.
Only, yes, a busload of Germans, which are always out in Death Valley in the middle of the summer and everywhere else in the Southwest. Say like it when it is strenuous. Apparently, we were at Badwater, and it was 115 degrees or so, and there was a whole busload of German tourists there out running around. I made it a point to walk a lot further than they did out on the salt flat, just to see how long I could take it, which was about maybe 10 minutes.
The Humphrey Bogart movie Sahara was on today, and you're talking about these Germans in the desert, and I see all these Germans walking to the water, you know, dropping their rifles, and I just watched that right before leaving. So. The image that's conjured.
I was thinking, of what could we talk about? You know, I've got a list of about 12 things here, and then I realized that we had both Bill and Walter Hill here. Walter Hill, film director. Walter here, and the questions people ask about, you know, what does the Air Force know, and what does the government know, and how do they, you know, release that information? And I was
they don't.
Well, the kind of things I've been hearing for the last few years, and for maybe 10 or 15 years I've known Bill, has been more like, you know, those questions are, some of the questions are so far away from what the proper answer would be, that it's like the quote about the Shakespeare quote is that, or not Shakespeare, that things are stranger than we can even imagine. The way the information flows and who gets it and what they do with it is a lot more complicated and stranger than most people can even imagine. And that's the fascinating part, actually. I was waiting for somebody to pick up that ball.
Well,
does somebody want to pick up that ball? I guess I'd have to be more specific. You know,
yeah, could you please be more specific, Greg?
Well, we'll take somebody like Rick Doty, who tells me 800 different things, a lot of which is mutually exclusive to each other, and 90% of which I have no way of checking. And I know some of it is outright complete fabrication and lies.
That's the beauty of what he's telling me.
Yeah, and the thing is, he's got it. I don't know what his view of it is. Bill probably has a lot better knowledge of what Rick Doty's view of the phenomenon and how it's handled is, and you do too, Walter, than any of us do. But I'm at pains to figure out exactly what he knows and what he thinks of it and why he says what he says. And other people like him do the same thing, or used to. I mean, the subject's kind of taken a nosedive in the last maybe, you know, 10 years or so.
Subject specifically, the general
UFO subject
of UFOs?
As it pertains to government people interacting,
because it's
with
all
using the information.
Because a lot of it's gone stale. We've had this conversation.
Yeah.
There's not a lot new. There's just a new generation that doesn't know what the old generation has already been through,
Bingo.
And so to them it's new. But there isn't enough of a new generation that's interested in it to really create a surge of interest as there was, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah, but the old generation was interested in what they wanted to know and not what was there, it seems like.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I don't know. It seemed like it was going a certain path that just kind of got cut short, and we got back to the basic standard ET hypothesis. And I don't know. That to me, has gone kind of stale, and maybe that's because of what you were saying.
Well, I agree. It has gone very stale, because what happened was that a lot of questions were raised. Some answers were given or procured, but for the most part, the questions that were raised weren't really answered. They were just discussed. And following that discussion, a lot of people just came away with the feeling that no matter what you do or who you are or how long you spend on it, there isn't a whole lot more you're going to find out unless you have some way of coming up with some very sophisticated, very special clearance or access or situation mm-hmm. which will get you in that black box.
Mm-hmm.
And the people just continuously run into the black box and recognize there's something there, but that's it. I guess those that get in it don't talk about it.
Mm.
Who gets in that box?
Well, we never know, because those that are in it, that have gotten in it, don't tell us they were.
Is that part of the entrance of getting into the box?
I don't know.
I would venture to say, yeah, because in that world, and Bill, you know this, you're constantly tested. That's been my experience. Constantly tested.
I was told several times basically the same thing, that you don't find the answers, they find you when it comes to this situation.
True.
And I found it interesting that in completing a book recently very controversial, The Da Vinci Code, which I just finished, it plays that same song. In other words, this of course about the Holy Grail and not UFOs, but mm-hmm. the old question about is there a bloodline originating with Jesus? Did he marry Mary Magdalene? You know,
the whole Holy Blood,
the
Holy
Priory
Grail
of Zion, you know, a generation 20 years ago was up on, because that was a bestseller, but not much has appeared since, and so this new generation, again, it's new material to them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in that book, they played the same song, that the Grail, you don't find the Grail, it finds you.
Mm.
And the inner circle of that information is extremely well-protected, very sophisticated, and it admits only those that it feels qualified. Once you get in, you never get out. So who's gonna spill
it?
Yeah. For what motive?
And the funny thing is, a lot of the personalities that people accused of being inside that box are so far outside of it that they must think it's laughable, which is why mm-hmm. they don't really talk to anybody. Somebody will go up to John Alexander and say, "You know what's going on here? Why don't you tell us?"
He doesn't, really. And in fact, John Alexander, bless his heart, and I like John and always have, and not to disparage John, but John is not, he's not a spook type. He's not an intelligence gatherer. He's someone who makes use of it once it is gathered.
Yeah.
And so he's extremely naive about the way that things are done in the Humint and Sigint.
Right.
Circles, because he just isn't in that loop.
Much like,
and to him, it's utterly impossible that somebody could
keep a secret from him.
Well, not only that, but that somebody could be involved with something like MJ-12 and play the covert games that they play, because after all, those kinds of things sometimes aren't in policy, so people wouldn't do that. He sat right there and told me that one time. I said, "Well, John, okay, in your office they don't."
Yeah.
You know, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen,
mm-hmm.
because take my word for it, it does.
Well, then there's somebody like Hal Puthoff who should know that kind of stuff and is not naive, and yet still he doesn't strike me as somebody that knows and isn't telling. He's more, in fact, he was trying to find out some things from you, and by extension through other people, from me, and he can't find that stuff out. And you would think that he would be somebody that could.
Compartmentalization. It goes all the way up. I mean, on high levels, there's compartmentalization, and it works. It works beautifully, so why stop using it?
Mm-hmm. And,
if you get really, really into a sensitive situation where maybe only half a dozen people are in on some bit of information or some the existence of some project or have the names and identities of operatives or whatever, mm-hmm. You might find that those people all have a common cover story.
Mm-hmm.
And if they get pushed to the wall, they will tell that cover story.
Sure.
And,
the same one.
It is carefully crafted so mm-hmm. that it is going to look like and feel like it's the real thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, what about this aspect, though? And this is something I feel like I encountered personally in what I was doing, was when you discover that the mission, the specialty, whatever it is, you're working every day, every hour on, you're committed to, when, you know, you kind of look deeper and you come to the conclusion that the cover story is so good that there's people living it, believing it's true.
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah. and so they really, I mean,
not
you talk
only that,
to
but
people.
You cannot tell them that it isn't because they don't want to hear it.
Exactly, exactly. Now, I got out of my last specialty because I came to a conclusion that, quite honestly, it was a cover for something else that was going on. And once I never proved it to myself, but once I believed that it was mm-hmm. possible that what I was dedicated to was bullshit, I got out. I'm like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. If it is bullshit, I don't want to just, you know, be going out there and putting people in danger or dedicating myself to something only to find out that, oh, what you were dedicated to, your mission was just a cover story. It was bullshit, you know. And, you know, some people can do it.
I sometimes get the feeling like,
well,
99%.
Well, yeah, some people can because obviously, you know, I was one of those people.
What I'm saying is there's a difference between, I think you were aware. What I'm talking about is you're an insider, and this thing that you don't talk about the details of that you do, that you've gone through, you know, the whole training, the whole immersion and stuff like that, and you believe it's the thing behind your cover. I mean, I had a cover story mm-hmm. for my daily activities, but what I thought was really the truth of the nugget of it all that they sat down and briefed you on in that dark corner, that turns out in itself to be possibly just another cover story.
A level of deception.
Yeah. And I think yours was more, you were aware. It's just like my basic duties. Yeah, I was lying to people all the time. And certain people at certain times, because my mission was such that those were crafted lies, you know, to make the mission work. And people could think what they wanted to about the mission. And that was a level I was aware of. But then came the next level of possibility where it was like, uh-oh. Okay, time to pull the cords and eject, you know?
Well, you have to remember, too, that diversion is a part of deception. If you
sure.
can divert the people's attention to something else that's going on, which yeah. is of great interest to them, but which
sure.
has nothing to do with
exactly.
what it is they're trying to find.
Yeah.
yeah. the heart and soul of the Benowitz story.
Well, that's what you do in double agentry. You make the bad guy spend all his time and energy on something that's
yeah.
bullshit. You know?
Yeah.
But you don't like to discover... you're eating the same bullshit that everyone else is. You know,
well,
you just kind of lose interest
that,
in it.
That
know?
Comment I made about Rick Doty starts to make more sense. I mean, he may be, what he's protecting is his ego about finding out that what he was dealing with and protecting was
yeah.
mostly crap.
Mm-hmm.
And the important stuff was the stuff he thought wasn't very important.
Yeah.
Possibly. Or maybe the stuff he was protecting he thought was important just didn't make any difference whatsoever, really.
Well,
although
I
some
think,
of it did. I mean, the,
I think Rick
the satellite
has a,
stuff and the...
Rick has a... the kind of personality that will plant some outrageous thing on you just to see what you do with it.
Yeah.
And how you react to it and what you do with it tells him a lot about who you are and what you are and how he can deal with you. And so he'll test you with things like that, just
well,
to see how
like
gullible
that.
You are, to see whether you'll pass it along and change it, or whether you'll try to find
well,
out
sounds,
the truth about it.
Sounds like his job description.
Yeah, basically it is. You know, I asked him one time early on, looked him right in the eye, and I said, Rick, come on, quit this nonsense and give me the straight scoop here. And I said, what is your specialty? What were you trained as? And he looked right at me. This I'd only known him a couple of months at that point. He looked right at me, and he says, deception. And we both laughed, but it was the truth, you know.
Yeah.
And he was straight out with it, you know, deception.
Uh huh. But it's frustrating to somebody a bottom feeder type like a civilian that's trying to find something out because they think he's their link, and then when they realize that his specialty is deception, they run away, turn away, throw rocks at him or whatever. Instead of looking past that and saying, well, okay, let's both realize that that's what you're doing, have a good laugh about it,
yeah.
and then go to the, you know, and move on and see what can be gleaned apart from
hey, someone's session. Calling for that free book from last week.
Yeah. I have to tell you to keep talking, otherwise I'll be dead air. Just a second.
Oh, here. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, my thing is I've come to the conclusion that the E.T. hypothesis is greatly in itself just the the magician's hand over here to keep you from looking at the truth over there kind of thing. And not that I don't believe in extraterrestrials. I certainly do. But I think that it's been used as, you know, what we're talking about, the deception to keep your eyes off of a truth about this world we live on right here. And, you know, so that I think a lot of what you're saying is that people will just quit listening to people and go look themselves. You know, if you think, okay, I've read this guy's book or I've heard this, you know, this is interesting, I'm going to go take a look for myself. Mm-hmm. And more people need to do that.
Yeah, but the most important thing about going looking is that you do not want to make the mistake of deciding up front what it is you want to find.
Oh, very good. True.
You want to go, if you're going to go looking, you need to go looking with an open mind and let the evidence lead you where it will.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Because if you
or
go
the deception.
Or the deception, but even the deception is evidence. If you keep an open mind and realize that even though he's telling you what you might want to hear, it might not be true.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to filter that and see. You know, until you can verify anything, you can't mm-hmm. accept anything.
Right. Well, look what you know. Greg was talking about earlier up in Death Valley. Now he's describing a light that he's seen. But how many people now, you know, for example, heard that? And they're telling someone, oh, you know, Greg Bishop's talking about this UFO or this alien UFO that he saw in Death Valley. Mm-hmm. They're adding that because, like you said, they're adding what they want to believe about that.
There's a difference between, somebody has pointed this out recently or a long time ago, between people in the UK and people here, but in general, people that are into the UFO subject, is when somebody says UFO, here people say Grays, extraterrestrials, aliens.
Yeah, I'm just sick of Grays.
And in the that's what I wanted to get into. On the other hand, at least they profess this, is that when somebody brings that up amongst somebody, you know, what's the big UK UFO organization that's just barely holding on by the skin of its teeth, publishes IUR, International UFO Reporter. I can't remember anymore.
Is that like Timothy Goode? Is he involved in that?
Yeah, QFOS. No, QFOS is American.
QFOS is American.
Yeah. Okay, well, the FS, Flying Saucer Review.
Is that still going?
Well, the magazine isn't, but I think the organization still
is.
Gordon
Creighton or something died?
Creighton. Yeah, I think it took a big downturn after that. It might be hanging on. Anyway, but their idea is, as soon as somebody mentions that, they don't think extraterrestrials, they just think unknown. At least that's what they profess to think.
Yeah.
I think that's largely true of the British attitude. They do not jump at the ET thing quite like the Americans do, at least not as many of them do.
Mm-hmm.
I found it also interesting that the French are more skeptical yet.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll look for some natural explanation before they'll accept an ET hypothesis. They're very skeptical about that.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like they're more...
Hence Valet.
Well, even Valet, you know, and his approach to things is rather specific. You know, he makes an effort to be scientific and to look at the data.
Uh-huh.
But I think he's more of a skeptic in his own way, perhaps, than, say, Alan Hynek was.
Yeah.
You know, Alan was more inclined to believe it because it was something he was looking for. Not that I'm trying to say that I respect one more than the other, but the approach to it was very different between the two men.
Mm-hmm. I got a mail. I told Bill about this. I got something in the mail from Martin Kottmeyer, if you know who that is. He's written on UFO stuff for a long time, pissed off a lot of people in the United States that are into UFOs, because he does that. He goes for the information. He looks for it. He always lets the information take him where it will and doesn't jump to any conclusions. But he wrote to me and asked me, and this was on one of these lists too, where the term grays first started being used. And nobody can really pin it down. It had come out in the mid to late 80s, I think, in some of the Benowitz stuff and Krista Tilton stuff. But before that, nobody can really pin down who was using that term.
Well, is it part of this cultural phenomenon that's been written about before? Bruce Rux wrote about it, too, where, you know, a movie or a TV show or a book or a radio show or something comes out, and then suddenly the depiction of the aliens in that manages to become the most reported depiction of aliens abducting people. And, I mean, these examples have been given multiple times, like the Interrupted Journey movie, you know, from the 70s with James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember that. After that, it's been the big heads with the black eyes and... You know, and right. Before that, it wasn't so much that, if
before
at all.
That, there were all kinds of different things. And in
exactly.
fact, actually, the thing that should have seemed to have turned that around was the Walton thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just wonder whether the term Grays didn't originate with that case.
With the Travis but, Walton
yeah.
case in Snowflake, Arizona, 1976 or 5?
Earlier, wasn't it?
I think it was 75.
I think it was 75, too. It was in that flap of... There were a whole bunch of cases in that one year. Pascagoula and so on. There were
oh, that's right. Time. So, and James Harder, who made himself the chief investigator in that case, doesn't want to talk about it. Doesn't want to talk about the subject anymore. Not surprising.
I remember hearing that term in the mid-80s. I don't remember exactly where I first heard it. I wouldn't go so far as to say that Benowitz coined it. I just don't think he did. I think it goes before that.
Yeah. And it wasn't... Was it in the first edition of Project Beta report?
And I couldn't swear to that, but it seems to me that it was.
Yeah. And that was 80... No, that was 1980, maybe.
That was 80. Yeah, that was in April of 80, I think.
Very early on.
Yeah.
You know, a free copy of Secret of the Amazon Queen to the first caller who can identify where Grays originated.
Yeah, well, prove it in an open debate here on the air. Actually, I haven't given the number out yet for the listeners. I did say in a few emails to different lists, etc., that Bill would answer questions over the phone. That is, provided the phone is actually working, which it had. We've had good luck with it. So the number to call if you wanted to ask Bill a question, or indeed Walter or any of us, is 213-252-0998. And we'll keep going here until we get a call, and then we'll probably go off in that tangent as soon as we hear about that. What?
I was just going to say, since you brought... Were you going to continue, or did you need to take a break?
No, no.
Oh. Since you brought up
take
valet...
Take a break at some point in the next few minutes.
That's kind of connected with... you know, my big thing is, because we were talking about the staleness of where the ET hypothesis is right now, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times getting out of that box, any box, can help you find the answers that are in the box that you're overlooking.
Right.
You know, my thing is, why don't we look more for the... And some people are doing it with the, you know, the Nazi UFO stuff and the Sonora Aero Club things like we've talked about. But what about, you know, hidden races on this planet? What about these being... You know, a lot of the people that love the ET hypothesis laugh at the idea of the, you know, races under the surface or
yeah.
in the planet.
And everybody else laughs
at
both of
them. And yet I look at them. Yeah, I look at them and I go, wait a minute. You're embracing... You're a true believer in the ET hypothesis and you're laughing at the hidden race hypothesis.
Yeah.
I find that in itself to be hilarious. Yeah. But there is a lot of historical evidence and other type evidence that would support that just as much, and some people would argue more, than the ET hypothesis being the answer, for example, the whole Roswell thing mm-hmm. and all those events that happen out there. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Bill, did you ever hear anything about that in connection with the Roswell? Was it always something from... piloted from above and not below?
Well, I never heard of any. Excuse me. Well, I choked to death here.
See what happens
I've never,
when you ask the wrong question?
Yeah. I've never heard of any underground civilization stories or information connected to any of the Roswell stuff. But I have heard those stories. You encounter them all over the place, of course. But I can't really say that I'm terribly sympathetic to them, because they were, I think, more easily credible when they first started to circulate in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and even into the 60s, because technology by that time was not such that at the level they are today, or that we are today. Mm-hmm. I think the problem today is that as we get more and more technological and more sophisticated in our ability to discern things with radar, you know, under the surface, that any such civilization would find it increasingly more difficult to hide. While they might have been able to hide in the 40s and 50s and 60s, could they do that now?
Yeah, well, they moved when they found that.
Of course, some people would argue that they're not hiding; they're being seen.
Yeah. Well, and some people would say what you were saying about detecting things in space, that we're getting better at that as well. And it would be harder for them to hide. Even though I understand that space is much more vast than the inside of any planet. Both could be argued, and actually there's been some guys who have made some very good points in their books that, though people say that, well, we got this technology and surely we know exactly what's at the core of the planet, when actually even today with this technology, even with the technology, we still haven't, at least what's been officially reported, really haven't probed under the ground as deeply as as people's perceptions of our technology would lead them to believe.
I think the deepest underground probes don't exceed, 5 or 6 miles?
Yeah.
Maybe. Not even 10, I don't think.
Yeah.
I don't think they've gotten to 10 miles yet.
So, it's like, it's a lot thicker than 5 or 6 miles.
You get down to 10 miles and it starts becoming very hot.
Yeah. Yeah, long before that.
Yeah. And that's a problem for equipment as well. I can't remember. I read an article
but
recently.
You
got to
wonder whether
to dig down further.
if say a remnant of civilization did exist at one time underground or in some remote area, whether as the rest of the planet began to catch up to them, they wouldn't see fit to simply assimilate themselves into some segment of that growing society in order to hide themselves, rather than to try to stay outside of that. Mm. And to me, that would make more sense. You might see some secret society which communicates within its closed group to its own people and preserves certain secrets, whether it's the Priory of Sion with the bloodline of Christ or whether it's the priory of something else with the technology that is beyond the level of what we think we're at today. So I would be inclined to think that if something like that existed, that's probably where you'd have to go looking for it. Some modern version of the Super Masons or something.
Walter, why do you subscribe to this theory so heavily, or why do you lean towards it?
Because I think the planet is still bigger than we give credit for. I think the space age sure has brought Mars and the Moon certainly closer to us. The idea of extraterrestrials has made space in our minds smaller. But just like the Challenger shuttle disaster reminded us how dangerous space travel is. I think really looking and reminding ourselves how big space is and how big just our planet is, is in need here. I think, for instance, one of the things, and it's a simple thing, and, I know there's a lot of people who could probably explain it away, but just as an example of the concept, take a look at, a nighttime satellite photo where they do the composite of, 9 p.m. everywhere on the world, everywhere on Earth. And you see where the clumps of civilization really lie, and they are surprisingly, even though 29% of land covers this planet, there's still surprisingly, they talk about overpopulation and all this stuff and crowding, surprisingly there's still huge dark areas.
Yeah,
which
in the middles of the continents, except for the North American continent.
Yeah, and you get in your car and you drive. You went out to Death Valley, and all of us have driven through the Southwest. I've done it numerous times, countless times, and you get out there on Highway 10, and you get out of any city area, and you're kind of reminded this is pretty wide open spaces. And when you go, wow, we live on a pretty good sized.
There's still canyons and places in southern Utah that don't have names yet.
And think of the other continents that are much more vast than ours. I mean, you know, the Russia,
South America,
the
Russia,
you know, China and stuff like that.
Australia.
And vast tracts of land where not too many people, you know, are going through there, not even every week. And the oceans, you know. I mean, they talk about, well, there's ships every day and stuff like that. But, you know, they go through shipping lanes, tried and true shipping lanes, and they're trying to get from point A to point B, you know, because money's involved. And there's vast tracts of the surface of the oceans of this planet that, you know, nobody, no human being ever crosses for weeks, months, maybe years at a time. Then they come up with the argument, satellites. Well, you know, my thing is this. You got to look at which satellites, who has access to them. People that have been hiding, let's say they are hiding, or something that's been hiding, you know, could probably, you know, possibly be sophisticated enough to understand, okay, they got eyes up there in the sky now. I'm just not... It's like the X-Files line. The best damn thing that ever came out of the X-Files, in my opinion, was the episode where Mulder meets Mr. X on that football field. And Mr. X says, and I'm paraphrasing, Mr. X says, why is it that people, in spite of... in spite of the... give me a second. why is it... in spite of, is it preponderance or the amount of or whatever?
Preponderance sounds good.
Of evidence, are you people not some of you people not convinced? And Mulder thinks about it for a second, and then he says, because the preponderance or whatever the word is, he's talking about an abundance of evidence is not entirely convincing. And Mr. X smiles and says, exactly. And I think we're being given this huge abundance of facts or factoids or whatever, a bunch of data thrown at us to convince us that, see, nothing could hide. And we're accepting more than we're questioning. And I think that's what's going on. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not even getting into the folkloric issues, which you have Valet turned me on to years ago, and I've continued to study. You know, I just think that there is a huge abundance of historical, I'll use the word evidence, or pointers or something that says, you know what, there might very well be more to this, and I think the reason it gets shoved aside or poo-pooed by people is, part of that is because it's, uh-oh, maybe that's where the magician's hand is that they don't want you to see. They want you to look at his hand with the ET hypothesis because the hand with the truth might be, might.
Yeah.
You know, might
there's
be that.
There's just as much room for that kind of truth as the other kind of truth that's been running around for the last 60 years now.
Yeah.
Or so. And since everybody's minds are on that rail, it's very hard to get them off that. I mean, most people's minds aren't even on that rail because it's not that important to most people.
Well, and think of the people involved with that particular rail, and we just were talking about just one guy who was involved in deception, and yet the true believer will still not do the math and go, oh, okay, gee, you know, maybe my pet theory is a deception. What I'm talking about now could be a crock of shit that's just been thrown out there, you know, to get people off the trail of the truth.
No.
But anyway.
Well, I'll give the number out again. It's Radio Misterioso here on killradio.org, here every Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And the number down here is 213-252-0998. If you want to ask, scare, or challenge either of our guests, Bill Moore or Walter Bosley. I don't know if you can ask, scare, or challenge me with anything. You probably could. Probably be far more interesting to ask one of these two gentlemen. Anyway, we're going to take a short break here. I played this for you last week, Walter, the Martians Aren't Coming song. And we'll listen to that for a little while. And then we'll be right back with Bill Moore and Walt Bosley here on Radio Misterioso.
Should we stop at Earth on our way to Saturn? No, Sarlacc, it's been a long journey from Rigel 16, and it might be nice to stop. But we're almost at Saturn, and Earth is pretty boring these days. Yes, you're right, Blair. It was in mismanaged Earth so poorly. I'd hate to see the shape it's in now. Last time we visited Earth, Sarlacc, it was a dump. Let's just give it and head straight to Saturn, even though Earth is the only place to get cheeseburgers in the whole galaxy.
things aren't coming anytime soon. But I have news for you. The Martians aren't coming today or any day. The Martians aren't coming. The Martians aren't coming. The Martians aren't coming. The Martians aren't coming. No. Easter fun is full of chocolate. Elvis is not alive and well. You are very beautiful, and I will always love you. Wake muskrats are bogus. Disney is not your friend. Babies are having babies. Marijuana shrinks your brain. Success of a scare depends on its edge, lies George and on.
We had a good discussion going on here, and I had this music going. And
that figure.
Yeah. Bill was. They were talking about what you're looking for, and if you're looking for something and you don't know what it is, and you find something you don't know what it is, you're already making a decision about what it is.
But at least you're seeing something.
Yeah, but you're seeing something. But you're in that space between your eyes and your ears and your nose and your mouth and your skin, and where it gets processed in your brain. There's an interpretation going on before it gets there, before you even realize it.
Based on and everyone's got their prejudices.
Yeah. And because your brain's trying to make sense of something, it's the way we're grounded in three dimensions and time flowing from future to past, how we operate.
I was making the point that it's easier from a logical, common sense point of view. It's easier to accept that there could be a, for lack of a better term here, alien presence on this planet, but in a limited way. There might be some base or some site, some area where some few individuals are present from time to time. They come and they go. But that there is no major presence, and perhaps this base or this contact point has been here for 2,000 or 3,000 years. That's a lot different than saying 50,000 or 100,000, some ancient civilization that is pre-modern man, pre-Cro-Magnon, if you will, and mm-hmm. survived for a couple of 100,000 years hidden away.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty hard to accept.
Or concurrent with the Cro-Magnon.
But a single, maybe a word that is good here because it is common in these days of terrorism, a single cell on the planet, mm-hmm. sophisticated in its own way, could perhaps remain hidden, especially if certain key people within the world's governments were aware of this and were part of the plan to keep it hidden.
Right.
Well, what about, say...
I'm not saying I accept this. I'm saying that I could find something like that easier to accept than to try to say that we're dealing with something ancient that has been hidden underground for many, many, many thousands of years. Whether this is an alien presence, whether this is perhaps some remnant of a human civilization that went off the planet and has come back, You know, it's hard to say because, of course, from that moment led to the question of, well, all right, nobody's going to, Walter here says he's not going to be convinced till he goes looking. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, even if you do go looking at some of these sites where activity has been mm-hmm. talked about or reported, you're never really, you can never really be sure that what you see, mm-hmm. what you think you're seeing, is what is really there anyway.
Because which applies to anything.
You know, if these, I've said so many times before, if whoever's behind this kind of technology is capable of manipulating our awareness of it, mm-hmm. then you don't know, you can't trust anything.
Yeah.
Because what your awareness is a manipulation of what they're doing.
Then why did you talk to Rick Doty?
Well, see, I mean, the whole ET hypothesis could be the same thing. There could be a third option here that is not being given any attention, you know, because both hypotheses could be just a deception in themselves, a manipulation. We were talking during the break about, you know, okay, the there is something flying around. We're calling it UFOs. What are they doing? What would they be doing? I had said, you know, what they do. Like, look what we do. Commerce. Maybe they're going between worlds. But then I just thought of, you know, the stories about the moon being hollow. You know, and there were in the early 60s when NASA first started going there, they talked about that. And then they quit talking about it.
Those stories originated with a man by the name of Virgil Postlewaithe. Mm-hmm. Who claimed that he had been with the CIA. Postie, they called him. Postie Postlewaithe. Mm-hmm. And Virgil was just a little bit more spacey in some ways than others. And I don't really give a lot of credence to the mm-hmm. Hollow Moon story because he seems to have been behind that.
So he was the one that talked about NASA allegedly.
He's the one that started circulating the stories as far as I could determine, and I don't give them a lot of credence because of that. I didn't give him a lot of credence. I think he was just another one of the lunatic fringe. Mm-hmm. I don't think the moon is hollow. It came from the fact that they there were some experiments that were done where they thumped the moon,
right,
in order to determine whether it would how it would transmit seismically.
Okay.
And it rang.
Yeah.
And so somebody said, well, what would cause it to do that? Could it be hollow? Mm-hmm. And that's what led to the story.
He went off
on left field with that story. But it turned out the moon kind of does ring, but it rings only because it has no liquid core. It's all solid.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, you can, it's a different kind of a ring than something that would be hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And we know it has a solid core. How?
Well, the question.
I know this is science.
The question can be determined by whether the vibration from the thump is transmitted directly through the moon, or whether it's transmitted right. around the moon.
Gotcha. Okay.
Through a surface, through a crust. If it's hollow, it's got to go around.
Yeah,
the difference in time, of course, will tell you whether it's going through or around.
Okay.
And so that pretty much settles that question.
What about, you know, and again, I'm not trying to, I'm probably coming off like a complete idiot to a lot of people, but I believe in, you know, step outside, ask the basic simple question,
mm-hmm.
even though sometimes you believe you know an answer to it, because I find that it helps to, you know, go back to, you know, whatever subject 101.
Well, we know
it's a mental exercise.
We know that we've hollowed out mountains.
Yes.
We've hollowed out underground areas, vast underground. Look at Manzano is just one example. That thing is huge under there. And you know, I can only speak from having seen minuscule parts of it.
Yeah.
You know, I was told there was...
This is a nuclear weapons storage area,
Mexico.
Former at Alamogordo at Kirtland Air Force Base.
Yeah, at Kirtland in Albuquerque.
Built in 1947, strangely enough.
Correct.
Hmm.
If we are capable of constructing those kinds of facilities, then one can postulate that perhaps an off-world presence or an other, let's say other presence on planet Earth might be hidden away in such a place. And such a place might be hidden away somewhere in the Himalayas. Or somewhere in the remote Andes of South America, or somewhere, you know, in the remote anywhere, you name it.
The poles.
And if there were only one such area, and if there were only a couple of spacecraft using it, and if there were only, say, a few dozen or maybe a few hundred beings connected with it,
sure.
I can understand the, or I didn't say understand, but I can accept the possibility that something like that could exist far easier than I could accept that something has been around for 100 or 200 or 50,000 years, you know, and has been trying to conceal itself and so on and so forth. Hmm. I think that's very hard, given especially the geologic changes that take place in such a time. You can go back to biblical legends if you want to, and they talk about the giants in the earth. They use the word gods in the plural.
Yeah.
Who were these gods? Who were these giants?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the times that we're writing about here is only 3,000 or 4,000 years
well,
ago, not 50,000.
And on the earth, in, under the earth, and in the earth.
Yes.
You know, very specifically, we'll say something.
You're talking
something.
From the top,
oh, like, something like that. You know, the on the earth, in the earth, under the earth thing. I find that kind of interesting, you know, those turns of phrases. And as we know, that particular document has been filtered and changed so much that, you know, you'd have to go back to the original one, and then even then, what did it borrow from? But I don't know. There's something, you know, sometimes there's just something that, for whatever reason, not that you're convinced, but... Your truth-o-meter, there's something about it.
I think you've
you're
got
get something
King
out of it.
Solomon's Mines fever.
Maybe.
Is what I think.
I don't know. I have a source who tells a very compelling story about this.
You've got this wanderlust fever that
yeah,
there is
sure.
some lost civilization buried yeah. down deep in the bowels of the earth. Which
Look at his shirt there.
If
oh,
you
no.
could only find
Not
it.
Lost Continent Library.
It's Adventures Unlimited.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing of it is, it's not completely out of the question. There's just enough glimmer there that you can follow a story like that and have some fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
But and people say you could say the exact same thing about the whole extraterrestrial hypothesis. There's no more evidence for that,
or the Holy Grail, or the Virgin Mary.
There you go. I mean, all of this could just be, you know, a big fairy tale. All of it, even the whole thing with the Greys, the whole thing about the abductions. I mean, it could all be a big fairy tale that somebody has decided is useful. You know, on one little piece of it, I know for a fact that OSIPJ loves this kind of stuff because
yes,
it makes their job
do.
Easier, we know. Okay?
Sure.
But I think on a bigger level, you know, all of the stuff, the parts that aren't true, and even the parts that might be true, I mean, it's all somebody's using this stuff. It, to cover something, and it might very well be quite mundane, you know, compared to what's being thrown out there in front of us, swirled out there, you know, to get our attention.
Especially if they're flying in and out of caves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Not aliens. I'm talking about regular military
right.
people.
Sure, yeah, you know, and if the people want, if it's easier to protect something by having them believe it's, you know, Greys from Zeta Reticuli, fine. Let's go ahead and keep perpetuating that myth, you know. But but it could be just as easy, you know. I don't know. I lost my thought there. I had a thought. It escaped me.
Did I jump your rail by talking about this?
No, I just...
Military flying,
you know,
in and out of massive caves?
It's one of those things that's, you know, you just... I think each person has to explore what to them... The path that to them seems the one that has the most to it, and you got to explore it to your own personal extent,
mm-hmm.
you know, and see what you find, you know, and in spite of the evidence against it. It goes back to that thing. It's like, because all the evidence to the contrary is not entirely convincing.
Yeah. What if you do go down to those tunnels in South America and follow them for 4 or 5 days or 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and all you find is more tunnels? What? How much more do you know about it?
Just not much more. There's more tunnels. But the thing is, if they are man-made, if you can prove that they're man-made and they're very old, that in itself is quite something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd be happy with that.
Right.
I'm going for, you know, Bill's kind of right here. Yeah, I'm just, the sense of adventure, hell yeah. That's half the reason we're alive is the adventure of it, you know? is the adventure of it. You know, the other stuff is all well and good, but just the adventure of being alive. I'm there for the adventure and the curiosity. David wants to do it. We're going to videotape it, which is, you know, I think important. If we just find more tunnels, we find more tunnels. Oh, well, you know, and it's very likely that's what we'll find.
Right.
But what would be nice is to be able to find some way to maybe date these things or contribute to data or evidence that might help date these things eventually.
Right.
But at least it's somebody going and looking at something rather than just, you know, hey, I read about it.
A piece of the puzzle or a piece that leads to another puzzle.
My understanding that, archaeologically speaking, it's extremely difficult to date caves.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're changing constantly, and because things fall off the ceiling and onto the floor and form layers, and so you know, it's extremely hard to maintain an integrity in a cave.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the discoveries of bones and artifacts that have been found in caves have remained controversial as to date for that very reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier if you can find them in situ in
dirt.
In dirt, exactly.
Sure.
And you know, another thing that enters into the question is even then you have a question of whether it can be relied upon. Suppose, for example, that an arrowhead which is maybe 3,000 or 4,000 years old,
mm-hmm.
and the arrowhead gets dropped on the ground and then kicked into an animal burrow, which drops it down a couple more layers geologically, maybe a foot or two deeper.
Uh-huh.
And that burrow then gets filled over, and 5,000 years later, that arrowhead gets found in a strata which is, you know, significantly 5,000 or 6,000 years older than the arrowhead itself.
Right.
So how do you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to guard against that sort of thing.
True.
And it's not a cut-and-dried thing at all. Radiocarbon dating is getting better.
Yeah.
We now can give dates within a much much more limited range of years than was previously possible, even a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
And so now you get ranges which maybe with plus or minus 150 years instead of plus or minus 650 years. And that is quite a difference. But dating rocks, tough.
Sure.
Real tough. And, you know, argon is one process, but even that's not very good beyond 50,000 years.
Yeah. Anything that's not sedimentary is very difficult.
Yeah. So, you know, finding a tunnel and then finding out how old that tunnel is
you know, like
questions.
I said, we're just making, you know, we want to have a couple of, you know, credible scientist types on the team. You know, David and I, David's the star power, you know, to make it happen. You know, I'm the logistics guy, and I'm going because I want to see this supposed alleged tunnel system, which David has seen part of. And, you know, we want to go. We kind of want to put our money where our mouth is, you know, talk about stuff, publish stuff, you know, think about it a lot. You know, let's go take a look at it, and let's see what we do see. Let's see whose interest we raise by going to have a look-see. See, that's half of it right there that I don't really talk about a lot is I know when I bring things up and, you know, when I plan, like, going on this thing with David, I am just as interested in who's going to pop up and say, oh, no, as I am what's down there. Because I'll tell you right now, if it gets to the point where somebody...
This is where now that you're going?
This particular expedition... is in South America in a little village. The entrance is in a little village called South Tomé das Letras, St. Thomas of the Letters, which is northwest of Sao Paulo, Brazil.
And this is in Brazil?
Yes, and in the 80s, the Brazilian army sent a patrol into this tunnel entrance, and they journeyed for 4 days before they found a larger room, which they're claiming the tunnel and the rooms hollowed out artificially, you know, or by hand, by man, very old, with three more tunnels going off of it deeper into the earth. Now, because of supplies and such like that, they had to turn around and come back out. David Childress has been in that tunnel, and he has seen it himself. He's gone like 4 or 5 hours deep into the thing and, you know, again, didn't have the appropriate supplies to go further, and he's always wanted to go back down into this tunnel with a camera crew and find and see if the large room is there and what, you know, what else we'll see along the way. And so we've put together part, most of a team, and even a potential camera crew, right from right here in L.A. And we have a Emmy Award-winning editor who's going to direct the thing, who's worked on documentaries before. And you know, it's hopefully going to be a serious effort once we do this thing. Serious, you know, fun, adventurous effort. But you know, we're just going to go down there and get on videotape and say, "Hey, isn't this interesting? Look at this tunnel. The thing has been here for centuries. People have known about it. This is part of that tunnel system which Atahualpa told Pizarro's guys that, you know, hey, this thing was old and was here when our people first came here. We don't know who the hell made these things." You know, and that's legend, but it's documented history that he told them that. We don't know the validity of that, of course, but other than these tunnels are there. And, you know, that's just the thing, is to go down there with the videotape and see what is there.
Mm-hmm. For the record, the oldest archaeological site in the Americas doesn't go back more than, and I'm stretching points here, more than about 20,000 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, for good documentation, doesn't go back more than about 14,000. Mm-hmm. There are some questionable sites in Brazil that go back perhaps as far as 40,000, and those are currently being excavated, but that's uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of questions about those.
Well, previously we're only supposed to say this for only like 8,000
years. Only because I just finished reading James Adovasio's book, The First Americans, which came out just this past year, and I found much of what he had to say on that subject very refreshing. In that, been a lot of new discoveries in the last 30 years, which have pushed back the date of early man in the Americas of several thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, there is nothing to suggest any kind of an advanced civilization, and there is nothing to suggest that anything goes back more than about 30 or maybe 40,000 years at the most.
In his studies and his opinion?
Well, anywhere, you know, known to American archaeology, either north or south.
Okay.
And he pushes it back a little further, apparently, than a lot of mainstream archaeologists are prepared to. Doesn't he?
Well, you hit the key phrase there, mainstream.
Well, Adovasio is the man responsible for excavating the Meadowcroft rock shelter site in Pennsylvania, about 30 miles south of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And it has documentable layers of human occupation all the way back to around 14,000 years ago, 14,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the dates have been verified by the Smithsonian. The research is impeccable. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. And in his discussion of that site, he goes into the research that corroborates it with other sites of apparently similar age,
mm-hmm.
and goes into a discussion of sites which could be older and the kind of evidence that exist in support of those sites, including this one in Brazil and South mm-hmm. America, which is, as I say, it's 30 or 40,000 years, but it's questionable. There's some the difficulty again is in being
able
entirely
to
sure of the layers because of water penetration and so forth.
True.
But I think you know, Adovasio is controversial only to archaeologists who still cling to the Clovis man was first theory, which is now pretty well discredited. That held sway from the 1930s until quite recently.
Which was only about what? About
Clovis man dates down to around 9,000 BC.
Yeah,
this is, you know, easily 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years before that.
Mm-hmm.
The question now appears to break down into not a single human migration across a land bridge from Asia, but rather multiple migrations over a period of several thousands of years by different ethnic groups of people
and
which
across the seas
didn't survive. And this includes, yes, crossing the oceans, mm-hmm. both Atlantic and Pacific, although the Pacific seems more likely than the Atlantic.
Sure.
But keep in mind that this Meadowcroft shelter is in Pennsylvania on the east coast near the Atlantic. It's not near Mexico and near the west coast near Alaska.
Right.
So it means that whoever settled that site either came down the West Coast, crossed the Rocky Mountains, mm-hmm. and got over to that point and settled there with the glacier, in essence, in place.
Yeah.
Or these people got there before that glacier did.
Exactly.
Or they came from the Atlantic side. Mm-hmm. So there's questions there that remain unanswered.
Were they able to determine what... was this a Caucasian people? Was this a... Because there's that question, too, you know, and that's a very political subject.
Well, the question right now seems to, as far as Caucasian features, seems to center on the Kennebec man,
mm-hmm.
Or Kennebec, depending on how you want to pronounce that. And I noticed just in the news 2 or 3 days ago that... even though a judge has now ruled in favor of the archaeologists who want to examine the remains, the government has taken another sidestep and thrown up procedural difficulties, and it looks like now that's going to end up back in court. So it may be another 10 to 20 years before.
Let's ask why.
They're afraid of something.
Yeah, they are afraid of
something. Somebody doesn't want it known that...
the red man wasn't the first... occupants of this continent.
Well, yes, and even Kennebec was probably not the first, because that only goes back to 9600 BC. Mm-hmm. And that's still, you know, 3,000 to 4,000
There's not enough remains for 14,000 years ago to tell.
Metacroft site.
Hey, yeah. I'm a believer in the diffusion theory, you know, and I think everybody's been everywhere on this planet. If you look at the, you know, it's the possibility that everyone's been everywhere throughout the course of, you know, human existence on this planet.
Well,
and why we get so wrapped up, it's because of politics.
True.
You know?
True.
And our recent history.
Going back to this question of who was first, though, there's another important thing to remember here, and that is that at the height of the last ice glacier...
Mm-hmm.
We've got about 3 minutes here before I have to change over this recording thing.
Okay.
At the height of the last glacier, there was so much water tied up in the glaciers that the level of the ocean was around 460 feet lower than it is now.
Easier to cross.
When they talk about an Alaskan land bridge, the word bridge is a terrible misnomer, because that strip was as much as 1,000 miles wide.
Right.
And it was not glaciered. It was bare of glaciers. So, it seems reasonable to presume that any group of settlers coming into a new land are going to hug the coastline. They're going to stick. They're not going to go inland right away.
Sure.
The first settlements are going to be coastal.
Yeah, and those are going to get bigger and bigger to where that's where the cluster of people
right.
always are.
Yet, because of the melting of the glaciers, those earliest sites are now 400 feet underwater and perhaps as much as 40 to 60 miles off the coast. That's why they haven't been found.
Which, well, they're starting to.
What we're finding is only those few remnants of inland settlements.
But we're starting to find the stuff, and again, in the case of Cuba, politics. I mean, you get... I'm sorry. You know, here's something possibly off the coast of Cuba, and because of idiotic politics... No, you can't come look at it. It's okay. You know, it's
well, they first of all, they don't want to find anything which flies in the face of the fundamentalist belief that the Earth is only 6,000 years old.
Oh, yeah, I know. I hear you.
You
there.
Know, that's a big catching point with a lot of fundamentalist Christians.
Uh-huh.
God created
the
Earth in 7 days.
The Earth was flat, right?
Well...
Years ago,
Let's not give them. I mean, seriously.
These were the. It was that kind of thinking that, you know, hey, the Earth is flat. Okay.
The thinking is flat. Is what it is.
Yeah. But the recent history of this of our country and the world is people have to say who was here first. Although it doesn't really matter anymore because the American Indians are making so much money off everybody else.
That's right.
They don't need to claim anything anymore. And I say more power to them.
Exactly.
Did either of you see those flying things on Mars pictures?
No.
I'll show you one of them here.
Cool.
This is a blow-up of the picture off the Spirit. And that's on the JPL site. There's a picture they were taking of the horizon, and this thing showed up.
Is there an animated one that shows it moving?
No, no, they don't. They don't have. They don't have enough memory, I think, on the thing to on the rover to justify that much that many images. And here's the one off the JPL site.
Yeah, but couldn't they put that together with over time?
They could, but the thing is they can't take enough pictures in the span of time to tell, you know, to if it's going to be one picture every 5 minutes, something has plenty of time to move. The funny thing is on the JPL site, when it says view full image, I told Bill about this. You go to that, it brings up something, and the dot isn't. Oh, there it is. Okay, I just couldn't see it on my computer. It's just this black dot in the sky on the horizon on Mars. And I don't know if it's a film, you know, an electronic aberration.
What is JPL saying it is?
I don't think they've commented on it at all. There's another picture they had where they were taking a picture of the sky, and there's a streaking something in the sky in the middle of the day, and they're saying it's either a meteorite or it might be one of the Viking probes that's actually in a polar orbit, because that would account for the streak the way it was going across the sky. Of course, Richard Hoagland and those people are going nuts and saying it's a flying saucer and from Mars. This one was intriguing to me though, because the thing looks like the dot there looks like it has about the same atmospheric perspective as anything else that would be that far away. Now, things right here, you know, the stuff on the rover are very clear. I don't know if there was a dot on here that you could see, like that dot. Maybe it's just the resolution of the picture, but they didn't clean it up or say anything about it, but plenty of people have been talking about this other thing. It's just this black dot looking like it might be maybe a couple of hundred feet or less hanging up above the surface, depending on where it is. It could be, you know, 20 miles away. Who knows?
That's which now? That's Spirit?
Yeah, that's the Spirit.
That's the Spirit rover.
Yeah.
Huh. No, I wasn't aware of this. I do check into that site every several days, but I haven't looked in on it since Thursday or Friday.
If you look in on it, it's apparently day 169, Sol 169. But the funny thing is, when I went to the JPL site and looked on Sol 169, I couldn't find it. But one of these actually is off the JPL site. Oh, yeah. This key. Thank you.
What if it's the men in black? What do you want me to tell them? Throw them out.
Tell them to come in. So I don't know about that spot. It's a very long, long address to give to you. But just do a web search on Mars Rover or Spirit Photo UFO, and it'll probably come up. So that's a very strange one. I don't know what to make of that. I'm not ready to draw any conclusion. I'm not going to go on Art Bell or whatever, George Norrie, which is where they've been talking about that some, and say that it's a UFO. I mean, it's a UFO with aliens in it. I have no idea. It's a black dot.
Yeah, it's all you can see is a black dot. It has no resolution to indicate anything. It might be just a data transmission dropout. Although it doesn't look like that, I confess that, you know, I've seen those in other pictures.
Yeah.
They don't look like that.
And the blow-up of it, you can see that blow-up I had of it,
on it.
Is, unfortunately, this is George Norrie's site. The blow-up of it, appears that it has this. Actually, you know what's funny right here is the bit mapping is a little bit different than the bit mapping around it, which makes it a little suspect.
Mm-hmm. Gives it that triangular look.
Yeah. It looks like a triangle.
Actually, like
or
a three-peaked hat a little bit, because the middle is like a black triangle or pyramid, mm-hmm. and then you got the little wings coming
yeah,
off the side.
Yeah, it's just that the resolution of the picture is such, it's done with, you know, electronic imaging with CCD cameras, so you're going to get this the bitmappy look. And in fact, it actually does look like it's more defined than the things around it, even the horizon here. So that either means it's closer or it was stuffed in there somehow. I don't know.
Maybe one of the Martian moons or something.
That could be it.
Visible in as a black thing in broad daylight?
Well, what time of day is this thing taken?
Oh, I don't know.
It may be. I'm only throwing that out there to discuss it. I'm not suggesting
mirage,
that's why it is.
Mirage, is that just a phenomenon of heat? Or can there be cold mirages?
Oh, this is from
the Arctic.
Day 33, this one.
Mirages all the time, right? Under certain circumstance conditions, there's mirage-like phenomena that occurs in cold.
Well, I would think you could have a mirage, but...
I mean, could it be, you know, something like that?
It's always a temperature difference that creates the mirage, because and the air, you know, you get a reflectivity off the air. There isn't a whole lot of air on Mars.
This is pretty uniform, right? I don't know. I'm not a scientist.
I don't know. What were you saying about day 33, Greg?
It actually the streaking thing was day 169. This apparently is Spirit's navigation camera from day 33. Which is a lot older. That was when it had only been there less than a little over a month, and I hadn't heard about this till now. Why did it take so long for anybody to notice that?
Yeah.
Maybe I just didn't know about it. The date on it was quite recent, so maybe it was found a lot before. You know,
free bag of
this.
Rolitos to the first caller who can identify when this
free bag of Pogie
Mars picture was first reported.
Who knows?
Well. How long after the first rover was the second one? Weren't
they
about a month apart?
Were they that far apart?
Or were they several weeks apart? Seems to me they were a month apart.
Yeah, it was about a month.
Could that be the second rover passing over on its landing pass?
Well, possibly, but you think that somebody would have made a big noise and said, look, you can see the other rover coming over. Rover coming over.
Too.
Wouldn't that be easy to identify with the fact that they know where these things are?
You'd think so, yeah.
I don't have much more on that than those two little pictures, because I didn't read up too much on it except to say that there were people on one of these UFO lists saying that was curious. They weren't saying what it was, but they said it was curious, to their credit. So I took a look at it, and I don't know what it is.
It's definitely curious.
Yeah, they were calling it a bunny that they were photographing that it was moving around.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that it was a piece of the packing, the kapok or fluff or whatever, from the lander.
Sure.
It wasn't anything Martian.
Uh-huh.
But there was quite a stir about that.
The other thing, maybe it's a piece of the lander being blown, you know,
a mile
or two or ten away.
That could be.
Flying through, you know, just floating up on an air current. You know, we were talking about those dust devil things, so obviously there's air movement there. That atmosphere is different, but air is heated, it rises, it does different things.
Yeah.
You know, very soon, this is not mysterious or weird at all, but very soon on Wednesday, the Perseid meteor shower is coming, and the prediction is it's going to be a better one. They always do this, but these are from people that have been pretty right in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. these two astronomers. One in D.C. and one in Holland, I think. Because of the way that Swift-Tuttle, which is the comet that left the trail that gives us the Perseids, meteor shower, because of the way its dust trail had traveled and how it had acted in the last few years and how it goes in 12-year cycles of heavier meteor showers, and it's been that way predictably ever since they've discovered this. Like clockwork, every 12 years they get a little bit more activity, and this is one of those 12 years, 2004. Mm-hmm. So I was interested to go. I wanted to go out to the desert on Wednesday night. I don't have to be at work the next day.
This Wednesday?
Mm-hmm. From midnight to 4 in the morning is the target time for that's the predicted heaviest amount of activity. You know, I went out and saw the Leonids. I saw the Perseids last year, maybe, you know, two or three a minute at the peak one time, which was exciting, but not like a shower. Mm. I think they had 100 a minute in China a few years ago.
Wow.
Which does qualify. No, a shower is, I think, 1,000. Isn't it?
Really? I didn't know there was a limit on it. But
there is where the definition clicks in is maybe it was 100, but anyway, I want to. If I can't get all the way out to the desert, Topanga is also a good place. In fact, when the Leonids came last year, there were probably 50 or 80 or 100 people sitting around the Topanga Canyon park up there. Topanga, the one at the top of Topanga Canyon. People were all out there in lawn chairs, and families were out there picnicking at 2 in the morning watching the meteors. And there weren't too many, but it was a lot more than, you know, than you'd normally see from there. So I wanted to go check that out and wanted to remind everybody that that's something that may be quite spectacular.
That song "Stars Fell on Alabama," that hit from the 30s, was about a meteor shower witnessed in Alabama, I think, in the 19th century. So that's coming up next week. Another thing I wanted to talk about is I got an email from somebody here at the station where Noam Chomsky, who I have some respect for, but not total like some people, as well as Howard Zinn, were saying they were going to vote for Nader because they both live in Pennsylvania, which that's Kerry's state, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because
Kerry's from Massachusetts, but his wife's from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they both live in, I think they both live in Pennsylvania, and the state's going to go for Kerry no matter what. It's kind of a given. They said they were going to vote for Nader just to make a statement because it's not wasting your vote in that case. And I was tending to agree with them. California's going to go for Kerry. There's almost no way around it.
Pennsylvania is a swing state. Massachusetts probably going to go for Kerry.
Okay, maybe they both live in Massachusetts. Well, Chomsky definitely does because he's at MIT.
Okay. Is Nader on the ballot in Massachusetts?
He may be.
Where yet?
Yeah. Who knows? They said they're going to vote for him. They must know that he's going to be on. They didn't say if he's on.
What kind of a statement are they making? That they're idiots?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, why would anybody vote for Nader this time around, given the disaster than the last time around? And I voted for him last time around.
Yeah, so did I.
I could say that.
Yeah, so did I.
But I'm certainly not going to vote for him this time.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to change my mind about how I'm going
to
vote. But
very, very misguided to try to get into this campaign. He would have been better off to suck up to the Democrats and support them.
Uh-huh. Walter's being very quiet now.
Oh, I don't want to
make myself sound like a real idiot and discuss politics because you guys are much more.
Oh God, I'm terrible at it.
That,
I don't know about politics.
See, I don't trust.
I know where I'm dumb.
I don't really trust the political, the whole political machine process in this country. Anyway,
you sound like a lot of my friends. I'm not going
to
vote anymore because,
kinda, you know, I don't trust it. This coming from a. Allegedly, you know, conservative ex-Fed type, you know.
Well, it comes down to this, and that is that, generally speaking, the Democrats want to use the power of government to help everybody.
Sure, yeah.
And the Republicans want to use the power of government to help themselves.
Oh.
And there is the difference.
Well, that's what the Democrats say,
you
but there's only
say,
a few
you
of them
could
that
say
I think
that
actually think that.
You could say that the Democrats want to use the power of the government to help people who don't want to help themselves. See, so both sides, and you know, the Republicans want to just have people, you know, have the government stay out of helping ourselves, and you know, that kind of thing. Both sides could argue that either side is an idiot, and both sides have a point. Either side is an idiot.
Yeah, but
both
yeah,
sides
exactly.
are guilty of. Both the bad thing and
right.
the right thing. And
right.
that's why, you know, that's
but,
confuses the hell
if
out of me.
If you look at the history of what's happened in the last, you know, even few, over the entire Reagan era, and then in the last almost 4 years since Bush got in, well, Bush is not even a Republican. He's way beyond that, and the people around him. When the Republicans control Congress and the Senate, It seems that a lot of people that already have money get to keep more of it, and everybody else,
yeah, corporate
everybody
welfare.
Else is pretty much left.
Well, that's what the rich
themselves.
Do, the powerful, wealthy do. No
that's what that's what I mean by help themselves.
Yeah,
I would venture to say the rich Democrats do the same thing, but
I would,
in different ways.
That's why I just said that that's what the Democrats say, but not all of them do that. Yeah. However, none of the Republicans say that.
Maybe they're just more honest. They're like, okay, you know what assholes we are. We're greedy bastards. We're just
right.
going to be honest about it.
Right, let's see. It's a choice between a glimmer of possible hope of not being all dead and in the toilet and none at all. And my father, who voted for Reagan and still reveres him, has said to me, he used the word fascist in the same sentence as Bush. That really floored me. And he still is a Reagan supporter.
Wow.
And I respect his opinion because every argument we have, he wins.
See, I'm
kind of like me with Bill.
I'm basically a Reagan supporter with caveats. See, so you know, I know some people would say, "What the hell does that mean?" But
you will never hear that on any other show on this station. You will never hear somebody
like
say
Reagan,
that.
But with caveats. I'm not one of those like my father's generation who just adored John F. Kennedy. You know, regardless of anything you could point out, I'm not that way about you know. Ronnie, but
if you don't mind cooties, I have water here. Oh, okay. Do you want any water, Bill?
No, thanks.
All right.
So, but you know, again, even I question.
Good.
Myself,
that means I can drink some.
The ones that I say I like, even I say, okay, am I being duped?
Right. Right.
You know. So,
well, you
without
were
venturing into being like my dear friend Paranoid Bill down in Peru, a member of the World Explorers Club. That any World Explorer members who've traveled in the last 2 years know who I'm
speaking
with.
Oh, yes, I've heard of him, yeah.
With great love and admiration of our good friend Paranoid Bill. I just try not to think about it so much.
Uh-huh. 213-252-0998. Nobody has called, but that's okay because we're having fun.
Nobody's called for that free book yet either.
Yeah.
That's amazing. A giveaway. My God, what does this say?
There's nobody out there.
There are people listening. I did look at the guy. I don't want to announce that on the air. It'll make... Oh, look, there's a call. Oh.
There we go.
He wants his bag of Rolitos more than the free book. Very tasty, actually. Yeah. So we'll see. Let's see what other subjects he had written down.
Yes, of course. Wait, let me put you on.
maybe we could channel it psychically.
Damn it, the phone thing isn't working.
Oh.
You tell them to fix it, will you?
The phone... Phone connection's not working.
Yeah, if you do it from outside the window, more people would hear you. Or see you. Thank you! Better come in here and say that.
I'm glad nobody called in because the phone thing is not working.
Maybe they have called in and you.
Yeah, no, the phone will ring. 213-252-0998. What were you in the middle of?
Giving away a book.
Politics.
Giving away a book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, giving away a free copy of Secret of the Amazon Queen from Lost Continent Library. First caller, you win a free copy. You know, we had talked about something that day we were having lunch about the Sonora Aero Club, and you seemed to know quite a bit about that, more than I did, so it sounded interesting.
Well, I don't know what else to say that I haven't already said about that, but I found the comments by Dennis Stacy in Jim Mosley's latest newsletter to be interesting. He attributes that artwork to more psychological means than any actual realities.
Uh-huh.
I forget, what does he call that, Greg? He had a name for that.
Outsider art.
Outsider art, yeah.
There's a museum in Baltimore called the Museum of Outsider Art, and it's basically a brand new, well, not brand new, maybe 6 or 7 years old museum, about like 3 or 4 stories, and it's all art made by untrained and usually unsung and not seeking any publicity artists. And Charles Delishaw, who is the person we were talking about, was one of these people. He drew all these airships,
dozens of scrapbooks.
Yeah,
the old style pulp paper. You know, kids' scrapbooks from around the turn of the century, 1900. And there were at least 32 of them that I knew of, and maybe a lot more than that.
Who found these things, and where did they find them?
Oh, that's a...
That'll take up the rest of the hour.
Some of them were found, they had been discarded, thrown out onto the street.
Yeah.
And a man that lived down the street found them and picked them up. And he was an artist, and that's why he was interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Navarro, who I understand has recently written a book on the Delshow question. But this man, Delshow, a German immigrant to Texas.
Houston.
He lived in the Houston area, but I don't think he came into Houston originally. Hmm. He was in some other part of Texas. He came in 1848. He came in from Germany. And he lived until 1926, I think.
Yeah.
And died. He was near 100 years old. And he lived in a, at least as much as we know about him, he lived in a room and worked in a room above a carriage house in the old part of Houston.
With his niece or something?
With his, I think it was his niece, yes, I think that's correct. Secluded. And he produced these scrapbooks of drawing after drawing after drawing of airships, not UFOs or airplanes, but literally airships.
Yeah, something that somebody in the 19th century thought would be capable of flying,
right.
Or at least he did.
And he, much of these things were embellished with clippings out of old newspapers or Scientific American magazines or similar kinds of things. And writings in both German and English, both very poor German and very poor English, and quite often in code.
Hmm.
So you had to actually decode it before you could translate it.
Must
and
not
he
have been
spoke
very
about
hard
what,
code
he, what he called the Sonora Aero Club, which he claimed existed around the time of the gold rush here in California, around 1850, in this little town
50.
Of Sonora, up northern California.
Uh-huh.
And that these men were a secret group or a secret society headed by a man named Peter Minnis. And Minnis is supposed to have been or discovered an anti-gravity, in essence, substance, which he called SUPE, S-U-P-E.
Yeah.
What that was and what it did and whether it really existed is the question, of course.
It was soup.
Anyway, throughout these books, scrapbooks, and I went through all of the ones that were available to me back 20 years ago, there were, I forget how many, but roughly three dozen, maybe four dozen names of individuals. And I wrote those all down.
Mm-hmm. Supposedly connected with the Sonora Aero
and
Club.
And then I went up to Sonora
mm-hmm.
and spent the better part of a week.
Where is that?
It is east of Sacramento, probably toward the mountains, but not in the foothills of the mountains. In the gold country, Tuolumne
uh-huh.
County.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Probably 80 miles, 100 miles from Sacramento. And right in the middle of the mother lode, what they call the mother lode country.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I spent quite a bit of time up there. My purpose being to try to document how many of the people on this list of names actually existed and
mm-hmm.
whether there was any connection between or among any of them
mm-hmm.
and whether there was any way to document whether Delshow
mm-hmm.
would turn up in that area. The bottom line is that I was able to document about half the name on the list, but I wasn't able to document any connection amongst those people, only that they were real people, or at least there were people by that name who were in that area at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I was not able to come up with anything documenting Delshow in that area at all.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I was not able to come up with anything documenting any activity of airships in that area at all. I did discover that the area in 1850 and for several years around 1850 contained one of the most active chapters of Eclampus Vetus Society in the United States. And they are known practical jokers.
Yeah.
And so whether all of this originated out of something that Eclampus Vetus Society was mixed up in or not, I don't know, but I always suspected that that was at least one avenue of explanation that, that ought to be considered.
Did you turn up any connection with this with anybody in New York in the California group? 'Cause,
well, yes and no. One of the other things about the Columbia, Sonora area is that there is no flat area up there of an extent which would be, at least in the 1850s, sufficient
suitable,
to build any kind of landing site for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Nor are there any records of any sheds or hangars or large barns or anything that would accommodate something like that.
Caverns.
Somebody would make some comment.
Uh-huh.
But what is...
Now, the question of the New York connection.
Yeah.
Two things. Del Shaw maintained that the group which was behind the Sonora Aero Club was called NYMZA, N-Y-M-Z-A. What was that, or was there such a thing? I never could find anything in New York that ever substantiated that there was any group called NYMZA, but I think Pete Navarro postulated that it might stand for New York Montezuma Association. And there is a Montezuma in New York along the Erie Canal. And, in fact, there's a Montezuma swamp section along the canal as well, a little town there.
Ah, swamp gas again.
The other connection, if indeed there was one, was that Del Shaw mentions the name of Wilson.
Yes, Hiram Wilson and William Wilson.
Well, he doesn't mention them in that way. He calls them Tosh Wilson. He's a nickname, T-O-S-H, Tosh Wilson.
Yeah.
Them?
It could be one. It could be more than one. I don't know what Tosh
was. In the very recent book by Michael Busby, he talks about Hiram and William Wilson, a father-son. And thus, there's that Wilson name again, which pops up deep into weirdness.
Yes, Wilson. The name Wilson turns up in the 1890s airship sightings. And supposedly, Wilson was the guy behind the airships. He had built them secretly. He was testing them. He was going to fly to Cuba.
Right.
And he landed in several places and met
asked
people
for water
and gave his name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, according to the Del Shaw books, Wilson, whom he calls Tosh Wilson might mean the brothers Wilson or the family Wilson or the, you know, who knows what that means. They were from, or he was, this Wilson was from, I'm trying to think of the name of the town in New York.
Goshen. What Busby says. Yeah, it's Goshen, G-O-S-H-E-N.
Maybe it was Goshen. I went to this town, anyway, that's named in the Del Shaw books, but it doesn't run in my mind that it was Goshen. Where is Goshen, do you know?
You would ask me that. I'm not sure exactly. I'd have to... I just remember that Busby... I read the book a couple of months ago, and I'm already suffering short-term memory loss since turning 40. It's really terrible, but it's in... I want to say it's in western New York, close to Pennsylvania, but I could be totally wrong. Greg's going to look it up on the internet right now. But I know that Goshen is the name connected with the Wilson father
the
and son.
The town I went to was very close to the New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania border.
And that might
where
be
they
the
come
one
together.
I'm totally wrong.
It wasn't too far from Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Which is up in the far northeastern corner of the state, right on the Delaware River.
Okay. Water Gap area.
Yes.
Okay.
Further north than the Water Gap.
Okay.
I spent a day there I was unable to document any Tosh Wilson or any other Wilson except the Wilsons that ran a dairy there.
Well, those are Wilsons.
I was unable to find anything connected with any airships in the day that I spent there, going through old records and so on and talking to the librarian and whatnot.
Where it is.
I cannot remember the name of the town. It might have been Goshen, but it just doesn't run in my mind that it was. Where is Goshen?
It looks like it's about 50 miles from New York City, upstate.
Yeah, upstate, okay. Well, you know, again,
get
the
up
Busby
and
book just
and
says...
look at the map, and I'll tell you right away whether it's the place I went to.
The Busby book just says the Wilsons were from Goshen. That, of course, not necessarily where all the airship building and designing might have gone on. You know, another thing that you talk about the individual who supposedly had the secret to the anti-gravity, maybe he understood the ancient secret of the Mercury vortex engine that, you know, has been talked about and written about, that allegedly the ancient Hindu Vimanas were flown. You know, our friend David Childress has written about that fairly extensively.
Sounds kind
maybe
of
maybe that's what the what was the word you said that the gentleman
Supa
maybe Supa was the same thing as maybe it was a Mercury vortex engine.
Looking at the map, Goshen is in roughly the right spot for the town that I went to. Now you got to remember this was more than 20 years ago. So
New York City's down.
In any case, the place I went was the place named in the Del Shaw books where this guy Wilson was from, and I could not find anything in that area that related to it. So I came up with a lot of blanks. Clearly there was a Del Shaw. Clearly he was obsessed with airships. Clearly he did reading on the subject, because there are clippings from the newspapers and magazines scattered throughout his scrapbook. So it wasn't just something that he dreamt up out of a fantasy. He kept up on whatever news items were coming out, or articles were coming out on flight. This is before the Wright brothers and after.
Right, yeah. Well, that's what the Busby book, you got to read this book by Michael Busby, B-U-S-B-Y. It's called Solving the Great Airship Mystery, the 1897 Airship Mystery. And it goes back into what you were talking about, the Gold Rush era, as being the earliest times this particular group of individuals. And he has done the name research. In fact, a lot of the book is him doing the same kind of thing you were saying, where he digs really deep. And it's the deepest I've ever seen anybody dig into that aspect. And he comes up with William Wilson, Hiram Wilson, and you know, some of these other names. And it's a really great book. It's,
does he mention
for what
the,
it's worth,
the E. Clampus Vetus connection with Sonora?
I don't recall him mentioning that. No.
Because
in fact,
to
I
me, that was the killer
this.
When I found that out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I thought, well, right away you got to be real, real suspicious, because
okay.
those guys were the, you know, the greatest practical jokers in society that.
Well, that was
time.
Was also the basis. The Practical Joker Society was also the basis of that Aurora, Texas thing.
Yes,
with the cow napping.
Well, see,
yes.
Now Busby talks about the Aurora sighting that's allegedly similar to Roswell, the crash.
Yeah,
Busby presents an explanation connected with his theory, what his book is about, with that.
Yeah,
he's claiming that a lot of Roswell is actually a borrowing of the Aurora thing, which was a crash of one of these Wilson brothers airships, and one of the crewmen was burned beyond recognition. And in the Aurora thing, it was it's a burned human, it's a burned man,
right?
And you know, this led to some of the legend about the
cow napping thing was a hoax, but the crash thing I've never heard any kind of conclusive.
The Aurora, Texas thing?
Yeah.
Well, everything that I read on that was not hysterical, you know, the kind of literature.
Historical and not hysterical.
Historical and not hysterical is a good way to put it. Pretty well laid it to rest that it just wasn't anything. You know, they located the windmill and the, you know, just nothing.
There was no Proctor there at the time.
Right.
So there was no crash is what you're saying.
Yeah.
As far as the
actual. Yeah, the whole thing seems to be. I wrote something about that, too, in one of our old Focus newsletters, but and I correct myself. I didn't write it. Jimmy Ward wrote it, and I edited it and sort of recast it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But I believe he wrote the original story.
Uh-huh.
And it pretty well dismissed it, too. It was kind of our position that it just didn't seem to go anywhere. APRO looked into it, I remember.
Right.
And, there was some question about wanting to probe into this supposed grave in the graveyard, which was the alien and whatnot. And
there was a big fight over that, too.
Somebody
stole the headstone.
Yeah. Yeah, there was one of the lunatic fringe researchers got mixed up in that.
It was the original burial site of the Kennewick man. That's what it was.
Yeah,
that's the secret.
And they moved him to Washington.
We're stepping on the other.
And that's
shows,
why the government is
exactly
all that. Call now for that free book. Last chance.
213-252-0998.
If you're interested in Amazon Queens, now is the time.
Right.
And if you're in Hollywood, I strongly recommend this book.
All right, Bill. Is there anything you wanted to push before we got off the air here, like the upcoming book?
Well, the upcoming book is coming up sometime in late fall. The Spalding Enigma, who really wrote the Book of Mormon. I'm waiting for Galleys at this point,
mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping they haven't butchered it too badly, but I don't know. I don't think they have. I think the gist of it is all there. What else can we say? We're out of time anyway, aren't we, basically?
Yes, pretty much. We don't stick to hard and fast rules here.
No, I my research of late has been along other lines, and I shift around from one thing to another, but I'm contemplating perhaps putting together another book project. I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen when this one comes out.
Uh-huh.
Whether I'll approach the same publisher, Concordia, with another religious.
And they are a religious publisher.
Yeah.
They're Lutheran,
the
right?
Lutheran, right. Missouri Synod Lutheran Church.
Uh-huh.
And I do have some ideas, along that line. I have quite a lot of research into some areas, but they're very conservative.
Yeah.
Be careful what you publish there, because their outlook is very, I won't say fundamentalist, they don't go that far, but they're very conservative. And as far as Lutherans go, they're the conservative wing of the church.
Uh-huh.
And they're very careful about the views that they espouse, as they should be.
Right.
They should be. So I think they're the perfect publisher for this Mormon book, because they're not the hysterical type. They stick to the facts. They're
right.
They're not going to allow any spurious material to get into the text or anything, any stretches of the imagination to get into there. They're checking everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, as it should be.
Yeah.
Everything was meticulous. There was 2,000 and some footnotes in that text.
Okay, we're almost done. Okay. Ready, Set, Go is chomping at the bit here. And right before they come in, Walter, is there something you wanted to mention before we are finished here about your website and or posters of scantily clad women?
Websites,
Queens.
Yeah, websites under major reconstruction is going to look really great here in a couple of weeks. The Amazon Queen movie thing is still in early development. We're shooting our first poster. We're going to have a poster series, Hot Babes. The usual stuff.
The usual stuff to keep the publishing going by actually making money.
Yeah, we're looking for a cash cow, folks.
Okay, this has been Radio Mysterioso. Our guests have been Bill Moore, who, if you're listening, I don't need to repeat who he is, and Walter Bosley, who, if you listen to my show on any kind of regular basis, I don't need to repeat who he is either. We'll be back next week from 8 to 10 p.m., possibly with another guest. I'm still trying to get Keel to come on and talk, because he said he'd do it. But,
really?
By the time I talk to him, he's going to forget he said yes. And it depends on his mood, so I might have to record it. So we'll see. Author of the Mothman Prophecy. Maybe he's heard about that Mothman picture from Ohio. Anyway, Ready, Set, Go's coming up.
Keel?
And Jackie's got a guest or a few guests. So let's put something on here to take us into that show. Here we go. Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft by the Langley School's Music Project. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
bridges.